This stand is good, very stable.
But the table is not stable.
After table settle, the chair is not comfortable. Good, that's how we need to improve things every year.
I realized, right?
Yeah.
Should I play a game? Use the fry that's chopstick to get another fry and eat the fry.
Hey, guys, focus. Look at this camera first. Let's start.
You ready? Everybody?
Then must hype up first one at the start. Yeah, it's like must hype up, like be. Okay.
Let's go.
Smile, show your teeth.
Yeah, I'm always showing my teeth. Oh, he's still chewing.
Show your teeth. All right, so we're going to kickstart our AMA episode. So this is Ask Me Anything. And let's give our audiences a round of applause for all the questions submitted. Okay, so what we're going to do is that one episode is going to be like a banter on a particular topic. So the previous episode we did this topic on about Singapore property price indexes. And this time around, we're going to answer some of the questions that has been on our NOTG YouTube channel for the past like couple of weeks or months. So let's kick start with the latest one first. And I think this particular question is pertaining to the solo episode that I did, because this particular episode, I talk about the HDB owner occupier scheme and, how the different kinds of like, start point of your property ownership, whether do you start from a condo first or HDB first, will then determine whether can you own a HDB and condo concurrently later on. So if you have not seen the episode, go back to the previous Ask Me Anything solo episode done by me. I went in depth into HDB ownership. And also there's this strategy whereby you can utilize, but that is subjected to HDB policy change. Okay. Mm. So, but in order to answer this question, if a young married couple go for a resale HDB now, a few years later, even a high income condo price will most likely be higher and will need dual income for a minimum 3 beta. Won't the HDB owner incur EBSD if the HDB is not sold prior to buying a condo? Okay. Now, let me just reframe this question a little bit. Mm. This particular scenario, in my previous episode, I was talking about the fact that if, let's say, now this couple do not have that set of down payment or income level to go for a condo, then you are maybe in a dilemma between going for a BTO and a resale HDB, and what should you do? And this is pertaining to the framework whereby you hope and you aspire to own a HDB plus a condo one day. Then what should you do? And it's with the same assumption. The couple cannot afford a condo now. Should they wait out? Because this question that I answered was in response to another question previously submitted by another couple. The couple was asking, hey, Melvin, I cannot afford a condo now. What do you think I should go for? I should go for a resale HDB or a BTO? So my answer is that if you cannot afford a condo now and you aspire to own a HDB plus a condo, then by taking action now, basically if you go to a BTO, there's a certain level of waiting period. If you go for a resale HDB, you have a shorter waiting period, because in a sense that your eventual outcome is still that you want to own the HDB to rent out, and you want to move into your condo. So you might as well shorten your time frame of owning the HDB. Go for the resale HDB, take the grant, fulfill 5 years. Within the 5 years, your income level will have increased, and then eventually go for the condo. If you compare that with getting a BTO, 4 plus 5, 9 years later, the condo price will be even higher than if you were to go for a condo 5 years later. So that was in response to the previous couple's answer. So I hope that answered your question. Maybe the rest of our presenters can also chip in a little bit. Like, what do you guys think? I mean, like, if somebody has the aspiration to own a HDB and a condo, what is your advice for them?
Okay, so maybe I start first.
Yeah.
Okay, so just to give some context, when you're doing an owner and occupier, the occupier finances will not be touched. That means in terms of the CPF, that will be untouched. And then monthly mortgage will still be purely under the owner. So the mindset to take away for this approach is, number one, during that 5 years of stay, or you know, if let's say you already go through with this approach, and then during the construction phase, if you add in a total of like say 8 years, probably after 8 years later, your CPF would have amount to say about close to $200,000 in terms of your CPF OA. If let's say you kind of want to project, you know, a few years later, once you reach this MOP and then the occupier name can come out to go and purchase another property, if the regulation do not change, what we are looking at is if let's say you want to buy something that is decent, $1.5 million, which is very rare really. And if let's say you want to go for something that's like 3 million, that's extremely rare. Firstly, your income need to be at least at about $12,000 in order to qualify for that loan, number one. Number two is the mindset to take away is during that 5 years or 7 years of window, you need to probably invest and be very prudent in terms of your expenditure. You can maybe look at safe funds of like maybe S&P 500, you put it into the funds and then grow at maybe 6 to 7%. And to ensure that you meet the overall down payment. And I think that is the mindset that a lot of our clients are adopting. If they feel that they cannot, and then while they are still holding on to the HDB, there will be equities that is being trapped in the HDB that you cannot fulfill. But of course, if let's say you can really aspire to invest and then to grow your funds, then this will be a very good approach because the yield for the rental for HDB will make a lot of sense. You can use that rental to offset your monthly mortgage if you can qualify for the loan as well as the down payment.
Yeah, I think this is confusing for some audiences because this is like what we call the owner-occupier scheme, which is like one spouse will be the owner, one spouse is an essential occupier. But of course, we always disclaim that this is subjected to change. Anytime if HDB comes up with a policy and say that this will not be allowed anymore, then of course, this will not work. But at this point in time, if let's say you are owning your HDB in an owner-occupier fashion, you fulfill your MOP, your occupier has a strong enough income to buy a private property on their own, you will not be subjected to ABSD and you can still keep your HDB, provided you started off at HDB as point number one first. So you always must start with HDB, fulfill your MOP, then you can own your private property. Some people who have already put in two names as both owners in the HDB, you cannot take out your name anymore. So you can only do the HDB plus occupier at the point of purchasing. So if you are already holding dual ownership, you cannot change anymore. So we hope that answers your question. Anyway, we already did about two episodes. We'll put in the reference link below. Let's move on to the next question.
If married couple wife owns a private property before marriage, now married, can they buy a resale HDB as a family nucleus with husband's name officially and wife as a essential occupier while keeping a condo? I think this one is quite straightforward. Yeah. If you already own a private property and right now you're going to resale HDB, you will have to let go of all your private property. If let's say you are also taking grants or you're going for BTO, you have to wait out a period of 30 months. Yeah. So definitely you cannot hold on to a condo and then proceed to buy a HDB even if the wife is just an occupier.
I think a lot of people also don't know that if you own overseas residential property, you also have to sell off everything.
Yes.
Next question. Yes. Yirong.
For singles, we can either buy BTO 2-room flexi or resale 3-room resale HDB. Which one of them is the best option for singles? If I were to buy 2-room flexi, I can only sell away after MOP 10 years. By the time after MOP, will properties to allow me to sell at a high price? Should I buy something in the new upcoming prime area will be a better choice? Thank you.
10 years because of what? BTO construction period? Huh?
Probably. Because actually the... It is still a 5-year MOP period for if you're buying a BTO 2-room flexi. I think in general sense, I'll need to know more information. But for myself, if I'm in this situation, I would definitely go for like a resale 3-room flat. Rationale is because a 2-room flat, essentially, you will not be able to rent out in the future, right? If it's for your own stay. As a 3-room HDB, there are a few multiple routes that I can go ahead with. Number one, I can stay in one of the bedrooms. I can rent out the other bedroom as an income generation to build towards my down payment for my potential next option. When the other thing will also be that I only have a 5-year time horizon to fulfill, which is the MOP period. After that, if my income allows me to get the loan for the next property, whether is it a bigger resale HDB or whether is it a private property, then that allows me to do that switch. So what I want in a portfolio is the flexibility to execute. So the lower the restriction in terms of execution in this sense is like minimum occupancy period, the shorter the better.
All right. Awesome. Great. Let's move on to the next one. Hi, Melvin. I've watched a lot of PLB and NOTG videos. I noticed you like penthouses. What's your thoughts on a small penthouse, 950 square feet living space and 500 square feet terrace for own state in the West, OCR4? It appears that small penthouses are harder through exit. So this in totality is about 1,450 square feet. I would say that it's still decent. It's still decent in a sense. Okay, but I think it would be good if I were to know how many bedrooms is this. Yeah. So the number of bedrooms is important. The configuration also plays a part. There's this episode that we did with, I think, 7 different layouts of penthouses. You can refer to Property Invest YouTube channel. Just type floor plan breakdown series. So there's the first version whereby all your bedrooms are on level 1. Level 2 is a blank roof. There's an, I would say a mid, era version whereby the master room is like on top, or maybe some bedrooms are on top. And then there's a nice spread. There's a difference in terms of, I think, exit speed in terms of these two kinds. And of course, duplexes, I think one benefit is that if this one has at least a 3-bedroom, then I think it is okay. But if it's like you're telling me it's a 1-bedder penthouse, then I think, you probably can avoid it. Or if it's a 1+study, you can avoid. But if at least it's like a 3-bedder, I think it's fine. And I think with the latest harmonization rule, it's also harder and harder to get penthouses because penthouses has evolved into an era whereby the last few years we have seen like the top level of new launches not having duplexes anymore, whereby developers build high ceiling for living and dining. But now with harmonization, they cannot sell the strata space already. So from 2024 onwards, I think we're going to see like total depletion of penthouses. Maybe only for certain boutique projects, then they will create like duplexes. But bigger projects, is very hard to get penthouses anymore. So unless this is like a 3 or maybe a 2+study, then I think it also depends, right, on the layout and stuff. If you can send us more details, I'll be very happy to answer.
I think even if a 3-bedder, I think the spread between the internal space and the external space, the ratio is, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, you have a bit too much external space for the amount of internal space that you have. I mean, even though this is already much better than the almost a 50-50% kind of spread.
Yep.
And
yeah.
And this is in the West OCR. Yeah. So usually in the OCR area, yeah, bigger number of bedrooms will.
And I think important is the quantum also. Yeah, so we need to know the quantum and PSF. If you can feed us the floor plan, number of bedrooms, quantum PSF, then we can advise easier. All right. Great. And of course, yes, you're right. I like penthouses. Next. Hey, Melvin, if I have $4 million in cash, would it be better? Okay, this is pertaining to my solo episode, but you guys are free to answer. If I have $4 million in cash, would it be better to invest in a landed or short house for investment? I'm 35. Staying in the inter terrace, we do not intend to move at the moment as we are comfortable with our place now. So with this information, maybe we can assume that you have your name in the residential already. And you want to go for one more landed. We don't know whether do you have an extra name with your spouse. But maybe, well, I mean, we can just keep it fluid lah. Talk about landed and short house as an investment point of view. What do you guys think? $4 million.
It's addressed to you.
Y'all can answer. Just imagine if you have $4 million yourself, what would you buy? And you only got two choices, landed or short house. And let's not talk about ABSD and all these things. Joanne, what would you buy?
I mean, instinctively, I would go for a landed. Just because I'm more in touch with landed versus shophouse, but I can understand if someone else who is very invested into the shophouse really, they might have different background of the market. But for me, because I suppose this is a investment play, right? Because you already have your own place of stay. So when I think about investment, then I also think about the future exit. One day should I need to. In general, I feel the market or the transactions within our local property market are still predominantly in the residential component. So I think in terms of exit, even if I were to just buy this $4 million, maybe it's a cat one, but huge land plot. I can just wait for the price of the land to rise. I don't have to do any rebuild because I'm not staying in it. It's a pure investment play. Once the price of the land increase and I think that I spot another opportunity, I can just exit. Yeah, so that would be my first stop.
Great. Yurong, how about you?
Okay, maybe let's define the shophouse to be a full commercial shophouse.
Yeah.
From that angle, I think number one, $4 million will not have a lot of choices with regards to a full commercial shophouses in terms of investment. And I think moving, of course, full commercial shophouses has been very rare in terms of performance, has been very well over the last 3 years. But that is mainly because of like part of the family offices that are being built coming to Singapore and channeling overseas funds to invest in Singapore properties without additional buyer stamp duty. And so moving ahead, I think that I think from a long-term kind of a risk reward perspective, I think that another landed property, I would probably invest in a inter-terrace or another landed property so that it is a little bit more safer. I want to play my cards on hand that I want to resell to a potential person that is going to stay. So hence, I still want to be focused on the residential segment. Assuming I have a free need, I don't have to pay ABSD. Reason why I'm not going to a shophouse is because it is a more speculative market. Because in our quadrant, right, we classify both landed and shophouses generally as quadrant properties, where meaning that they have high appreciation potential, but they have like lower rental yield attributes. And we are looking for that appreciation in the long term to outpace that kind of like rental that we can collect in the short term, so that overall it makes sense from an investment perspective. So from a shophouse rationale, is because I think it ties in greatly with two things. Number one, economic sentiments, because whether if the economy is not doing well, then your shophouse performance will dramatically be impacted immediately, because businesses, rental yield, all that will be impacted. Whereas for a lender, which is for own stay, right, even when the economy is not doing too well, as long as it is in a sought after area, there will still be good traction in terms of ease of exit. So I think all in all, risk versus reward, I will be more, a bit inclined more towards the inter-terrace.
Yeah, I think the landed market transaction is still the largest. Anyway, for $4 million, definitely when you look at short houses, you can only buy residential short houses. Full commercial is 10 over million already.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this kind will either be like 99 years, but it will still be a mix of commercial level with resi, which there's also a new ruling that if foreigners want to buy, they have to seek prior approval.
Mm. Now you need to go to like Little India, then you can find quantum for like shop houses lah.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, let me sum up. So this particular audience is saying that past transaction valuation methodology is flawed. It favors new and sizable developments. Okay. Lack of transaction for a small boutique project does not necessarily mean a lack of demand. It could be a lack of supply. Okay. Not everyone enjoys staying in a small high price unit in a densely packed project. So it's talking about big and boutique projects valuation. It is flawed. Technically in Singapore, it is in a sense because, they look at transaction volume. Does it make sense to support the current new launch prices, no matter how high the developer margins are? New launches now, no matter CCR, RCR, OCR, all launching about the same prices, regardless of land cost, does that mean location doesn't matter? Okay, let's answer that part first. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the volume effect. Boutique versus large size developments, valuation. Why is it that there's a huge percentage when it comes to bank valuations, right? They look at transactions past the last 12 months
within the development.
Yeah, and then of course this, a lot of boutique projects suffer in the sense that lack of transactions. When the next owner want to sell, there's a lack of transactions to support the latest PSF around the region.
Yep.
Yeah. So share a little bit about that. By the way, we talked about that a lot in previous episode. We can still talk a little bit about this first.
I think for the valuation, yes, I agree. However, I don't think it really affects your sale price. There's two ways to look at it. One is, of course, you peg against the last transaction. The other one is if we take a look at the macro view, we can always have this. We will always compare in terms of the floor plan, in terms of the layout, how then this price stack against the bigger projects in the surrounding. Usually, in terms of wanting to sell a property, if let's say that's the angle that you're coming from, is to try to peg against the recent transactions around the bigger projects, and then we try to push in terms of the valuation to see whether that can be matched. And then that will usually constitute, to ensure that the seller do not shortchange themselves when they want to sell, which I think we have overcome a couple of times.
Right? Yes. Okay. My explanation is like this. This has a lot of human psychology. For example, I think, okay, the dilemma comes when seller A owns a boutique project. PSF, when they want to sell, when they call their banker, they own a 3-bedder, 1,000 square feet, and they call their banker, they say, oh, their PSF is 1,003. So your valuation is 1.3 million. But then this owner will look at the neighbor beside this big project, the 3-bedder, 99 years, but his is freehold, this is 99 years, 1,000 square feet, 3-bedder, but the PSF is 1,007. Valuation 1.7 million. Then the freehold owner will be thinking, why is it that I'm 1.3, he's 1.7, we are about the same age, I'm freehold, he's 99. And the banker maybe will say that, oh, because your last transaction was 3 years ago, there was not enough transaction. There was a last done at about 1.3. Sorry, there was a last done at 1.2. Sorry, max I can push for is 1.3. Even though this 99's neighbor is 1.7. So there's two impact in human psychology. Because when you want to sell to the next buyer, your next buyer will also check the last transaction.
Yes.
If you want to sell at 1.7, your next buyer will think, hey, last time was 1.2. Now I need to buy at 1.7. I cannot even take a loan. Because even when the buyer called their own banker, their own banker also give them a max valuation of 1.3. It means that 1.3, you take 75% of 1.3 for your loan, you have to top up 400,000 in terms of cash.
Mm.
So I think from this point of view, it's like the buyer has a lot of so-called like obstacles to even buy at 1.7 million, even if they want to. And this is, of course, like, I wouldn't say it's like a flawed system or whatever, but I think banks will definitely need something to pack their rationale for the valuations, and which is why they look at past transactions as an indicator. And that is actually a huge weightage for the bank's point of view.
Okay, I think so. George and Melvin has covered the selling angle. So if you are now, if you are having this question because you own a boutique project, right? So I think how PLB can bridge the gap is through analysis with the regions around, and maybe try to find a specific angle where you can stand out. Plus our partnership with bankers to help potentially be able to match a better valuation than what you've gotten to help you to achieve a better exit price. But if today you are a buyer, then I think this doesn't matter. You're playing a game, you follow the rules, and then you use the best strategy that will help you to build your property portfolio. That's my answer.
Yeah. Okay, great. So of course, end of the day, I think there will still be buyers for boutique and bigger projects. Yep. It boils down to you want to focus your priority more on preference of privacy, or you know, like you don't want to be too crowded, you want more privacy, or is the appreciation a top priority? So that will be preference.
Actually, there's also two more points. Like usually when we talk about boutique, right, we're really talking about like those that are less than 100 units and they are all like small floor plate kind of units. There are also a lot of projects where big floor plate units, 2,000, 3,000 square feet. They are boutique projects. Maybe they are only 20, 30 units. However, these are usually land that has good potential for en bloc because it's easy for the next developer to digest, as we've seen from the past en bloc trends as well. So it's not saying that, okay, boutique project. It's more of like the investment strategy will be different as well. Now, of course, next thing will be, if we'll compare leasehold and freehold, I will say that the main difference from a buyer standpoint or a renter standpoint is that the bigger project will have more facilities that they can enjoy immediately as compared to a boutique project that which usually doesn't come with much facilities. And if you're talking about like the freehold status, this will be, I would say like more like a future kind of enjoyment, like for legacy planning, rather than like a immediate gameplay. So I think that also boils down in terms of like the psychology. One of the motivators to, let's say, for people to switch from HDB to a condo, one of the major difference is, of course, security as well as facilities for their family, for their young children especially.
Okay, so I think there's like 3-4 questions here. Okay, which are good questions, so we appreciate. Okay, let's talk about these two questions. Thanks, Yurong, for answering that one just now. So this is talking about, does it make sense to buy new launches no matter how high developer margins are? That's question number one. And maybe let's answer question number one first. Then we answer question number two. Question number one is talking about the fact that, I don't know, maybe it's phrased in a way whereby it's saying that the new launch prices are controlled by developers because developers increase their margin. That's why the new launch prices are so high. Maybe y'all can share whether it is true or not.
Okay, from a business angle, of course, developers can launch at any price that they want. So I think, for example, Jaden performed well and the developers have very strong margin. Highest PSF 2009 per square feet for a 40th story one bedder in Jurong East. So in this kind of scenario, I would say that from an investment angle, it is important to do your own, to have the right consultant, do the right pricing analysis for you. And if you overpay, then of course, it will take you way longer in terms of holding period to actually see that kind of price appreciation that you want. So it wouldn't make sense to just enter no matter how high the margin is from an investment angle.
I think whether or not it makes sense to support the current new launch pricing, I guess when most buyers buy into new launches, there is inevitably the investment component. So I think another key sort of indicator to also take note is also to see how the resale in the area is performing. If let's say the prices are really too high or like the resale in the area is really not doing well, then maybe in this case, it doesn't really make sense to support and maybe there are better opportunities elsewhere. But it is true that, you know, in general, the land prices are also going up. Investors costing on their site, manpower, labor, materials, all these are also going up, which is why, of course, these days, then the launch prices are higher. This is just as a matter of fact. But whether or not it makes sense for you to go in and enter, then it also requires a lot more deep dive analysis into the location, the surrounding, comparing with the research around the area, and also like all the small micro selection factors that we talk about.
Yeah. So maybe I offer a perspective because this has a lot to do with the supply level. There's a lot of countries whereby you buy a new launch condo today, and then maybe 10 years later, when you want to sell your condo, you cannot sell because the new launch at the 10th year mark. So when you want to sell your condo, you bought your condo now, 10 years later, you want to sell, but the new launches around you are launched at the same price that you bought 10 years ago because there's just simply too much land. Yeah. So this is what we call a free market kind of thing, because when the government released government land sales, developers will bid for it. And because of the fact that our government controls the amount of land being released, developers will definitely know that there's only a certain amount of plots that are available to bid. And naturally, I think there's not a lot of research tools available online to subscribe, or you can just check for our consultants. There's a calculation in terms of the rough estimated break-even price of developers, the land bid price plus their cost and all that, their land bid, I mean the construction costs, their architect fees and all that. So when you add it up, there is like a rough estimated break-even PPR, then you can see how much their margin, which naturally this is also a business that developers have to sustain because they loan from the bank, they construct, they take a risk of 3 to 4 years. They also have to make sure that they are sustainable. If not, they will collapse. So naturally a margin is needed. But of course, in certain cases, there are higher margins, there are lower margins. And I think most importantly is really to see this launch PSF in accordance to resale plus other launches launching concurrently in certain regions. Yeah. And I think you can check with
we can look at the margins as like a last micro analysis. Of course, the big picture analysis, like what you mentioned, we actually see the big picture first. The last micro analysis in terms of margin is that like 15 to 20% is
reasonable.
Right now the reasonable standard kind of margins. But of course, if let's say this developer is launching at a price that is probably 25% margin, then of course, you need to be more cautious in that sense, because if it is launched in an area where the supply is not very rare, what happens is the sales might not be very good. Maybe it's a 20%, 25% take-up rate. And down the road, because of that margin that was launched for the first-hand buyers, the developers actually have the bandwidth to potentially reduce pricing to entice the movement of the remaining units, which we have seen from past examples. So margin could be one of the last thing if you are like trying to struggle between two projects, right? And maybe it could be a safer bet. Let's say all attributes are the same, and then the one with the lower margin could be that tipping point to make it a better investment.
Okay, so next question. New launches now, no matter CCR, RCR, OCR, are all launching about the same prices regardless of land cost. Does that mean location doesn't matter? Come, anybody wants to answer this? Is it true? Are they launching at the same price?
I don't think they are launching at the same price. Actually, it depends on whether are we comparing like the right bedroom type against, you know, the rest of the other areas. Firstly, I don't think it's launching at the same price. Secondly is, I still feel that it's location is not all encompassing factors to determine the property. Against with our moat analysis, I think there's a few other factors that will kind of determine whether, you know, is that a good buy? And I think ultimately, when you look at your entry price, if let's say you're looking at new launches, what is the kind of disparity percentage with regards to the resale in the entire area? And I think all this will determine whether do we feel that it is overpriced. But location aside, I think there's a lot of other factors to help determine whether, you know, do you feel that it's a good buy or not.
So this is the list of median PSF transacted for new launches in 2023. As you can see, this will launch and transacted at a range. Right? For example, you have like,
we can actually summarize that. So outside central region for 2023 will be about like 2,000, 2050, 2,001 per square feet. RCR on average median will be about 2,550 per square feet. CCR will be about $3,000 per square feet. So you can see in terms of various market segment, there's about $500 gap. However, because OCR sometimes can be quite huge, if you are at the end of the OCR, meaning that you're at the edge of Singapore, of course you will expect that the PSF to be slightly lower. But if you're at the starting of the OCR where you're just outside RCR, then sometimes it could make sense that the gap towards the RCR pricing is relatively close. So as we have to also measure in that kind of context, but generally it's $500 per square feet across different market segments.
Yeah. Mm. So this is what we mean. The dark blue bar is the land PSF PPR. That means the land purchase cost, and then of course the break even with the costing and the estimated launch price. So if you'd like to have this chart, of course, you can give any of our consultants a call. They'll be very happy to share with you more. And as you can see, it's launched in a different range. They're definitely not launched at the same price.
Mm. Actually, for this, just something to share. So I think the general definition of location right now is also slightly, there's a slight subtle twist in that it's not about whether you are in, you know, like your prime districts in terms of that location, but rather how convenient are you located to all the amenities to transport nodes. It's about your location of your development versus all the amenities and conveniences around. If you have that, even if you are in the OCR, you're at the extreme end, Pasir Ris, but if you have that, I'm pretty sure Pasir Ris 8 PSF can still be higher than some of the other RCR. Maybe they're not so conveniently located to transport nodes, to your amenities, to your malls and all that. So I think location these days, it is also about, of course, where you are, like which district plays a part. The other thing is also to think about in terms of the livability, because ultimately, most of the transactions that are taking place are also for residential own stay needs. It's not that you are investing into a piece of land and you're just waiting for it to you know, the land price to rise over time. You also have to take into account what is all the conveniences, the amenities, because all these also add value to that project as well. Yeah, that's my
as well as good schools.
Yes, correct.
And I mean, like, there's so many different projects outperforming one another, regardless of regions, right? Regardless of OCR, CCR, and RCR. Can you guys name a few certain projects that outperform, like CCR?
A lot of projects outperform CCR. I mean,
just share
a few.
Esperina,
Esta, Penrose,
Centuries.
Yes. Yeah. Centuries, yes, Centuries very well
very
over
well.
The last 3 years.
Some of the older condos at Lakeside are also doing very well.
River
Caspian,
Park
Lakeshore.
In Pong,
yeah, River Park.
Choa Chu Kang condos are also doing very
Wonder
well.
Vale, yeah. Soul Acres. The list goes
why
on.
Why are you all the easy?
That's the case, what?
Okay, come, let's move on. Okay, on $1 million flats, regardless of remaining, this is HDB supporting these valuations. Now, what do you guys think? Those $1 million transacted, do HDB match the valuation?
No. For the old ones, no.
Yeah. So I think there's we can deep dive this question a little bit. To answer the question on valuation, what is usually happened for HDB is that buyers and sellers, they will not know the valuation. Only once the price has been agreed between buyers and sellers, the buyers will then submit the OTP, and then that is at a point of time that the buyers would then know the valuation. So firstly, that will answer on how we can get a valuation. Secondly, is that I think it's not really on a case of whether it's HDB supporting, but it's whether the buyers are okay to buy in at this price tag. And I think increasingly nowadays, various prime location HDBs are all crossing the 1.2 million price tag already. And that seems to be the norm. Why is that so? It's also because the rest of the other private developments in the area are almost twice the price for the same type of size. So hence, this become the next cheaper alternative. And then buyers are willing to pay and fork out the additional COV. And the COV range in like the prime area, we are talking about 80, 90K. If those at the higher floor unblocked view, the COV will then widen. So it's not about HDB supporting, but it's whether the buyers in the area are willing to pay at this price tag.
Right.
Okay, great. Let's move on.
If I don't look at OCR, is Diamond View 20 years old entry price at 1004 PSF a good buy? This is a question that George is very suitable to answer.
You answer now, why is it yaw?
You have an investor that entered this project, right? So
you all sold this property before, right?
Not me.
Not me.
Not me.
Diamond View. Tenor 1997, TOP 7 years later, considered D15. 148 units, high rise at a junction. Address is Hick Road. Upward trending price graph. Profitable transaction 132, unprofitable 11. Let's have a look at the price. Now it's about 1,000, 3,004.
I think it's worth considering. You still have some legs to go.
3 bedrooms is about 1.6, 1.7.
Yeah. I mean for the location, I think for that per square feet is very attractive. Of course, this is if you focus and emphasize on location. Yeah, not too hard in terms of like, okay, facade of like the building or
the
like,
facade,
you
know, the is facilities.
I mean, in the sense that, you know, like you don't need the modern kind of facade. You don't need like to have like a lot of facilities. Then I think for the location is good for that entry.
I share my perspective. If you look at the area, the rest of the other developments are largely freehold. So naturally, freehold will command a premium. So, but ultimately, when buyer wants to buy into a development, the quantum will still have to be a huge consideration because the loan will then be a factor. Over at this area, you are supported by, of course, firstly, the prime location, D15. You are also in a potential growth area because you have lots of new launches that is already crossing your 2000 over PSF mark. You have the school factors that is within 1 km. So,
Guanghua.
Yeah, I think so. So, when you buy into this development, of course, maybe the first question you are thinking of is the lease. Whether can you still sell, and then whether can you still profit? I think to have a clearer picture, of course, you can then take a look at some of the 99 years project that are along the entire Bayshore belts. Even at the age of having a balance sheet of 50 plus 60 years, people still buy into that because I think back to the fundamentals of the kind of mode analysis that we are talking about. So I think in short, if you look at the PSF, you look at the quantum, and most importantly, the layout, there's no wasted space for Dunman View. I still think it's a relatively good buy. You can still buy into it. And then you can still exit comfortably.
Will you buy Dunman View or Grand Dunman? Dunman View now, the asking price for a 3-bedder is about 1.8, 1.9 million. And then Grand Dunman...
2.7 onwards.
I'll buy Dunman View. But I won't take too long. I won't take too long to exit. Or probably...
It's 20... How many years?
20-something.
27 years. We have a balance of 72 years.
I'll buy. I will probably exit in the next 3 to 4 years because 3 to 4 years later, that is when a lot of, you know, new launches over there, they will already be hitting the resale market already. So
will you buy a 2-bedder dual key at Grand Dunman for 1.9 million or a 3-bedder Dunman View at 1.9 million?
Dunman View. My opinion of, dual key is that dual key naturally will cost more. A 2-bedder dual key will naturally cost more than a 2-bedder because of its higher overall floor plate. But yeah, I'll go for a 3-bedder Dunman View.
Fantastic. How about you, Rong?
I think that depends on the suitability of investments. So of course, there are certain buyers that are very concerned over resale houses that are at this age. Because they understand that the concept of the ballast curve, right, that it will go down to $0 at the end of the lease. And hence, they are very concerned that at the 70-year-old kind of mark, right, it is reaching the tipping point of the depreciation cycle. So of course, these kind of houses, I think when you put in the right context of the economic climate, right, so if let's say you have like a bull run where the newer condos in the vicinity rise up rapidly, it will help to uplift the pricing. Assuming if the market is stagnant, then hence this will become like a dangerous product in that sense. So if you were to just look at the bigger context, simple numbers, 1,004, if you can still get it at 1,004 because everybody's asking it's at 1,006 due to all the launches at like 2.5 to 2.7 in that vicinity. So assuming that you can really get 1,004, for example, and 1,004 is not because you are getting like a super low floor rate facing the windshield kind of attribute. Versus like a 2.5, 2.6, I think like the disparity at the moment at least is justifiable. Okay, if let's say you are the next buyer, you are the seller now, right? People will not think that the entry price is just $1,400 because they have to account for the renovation costing. Usually, if let's say this is the original condition, people might need to come up with another 100 to 150K. So that could be another $100 per square feet that is being loaded to make it as the entry price for your buyer.
Great. So if we look at, thanks, Yuron. You look at Dunman View now, is 1,005, 1,006 in terms of asking price. Quantum is about 1.9 million. We can just take that range. I think if you buy now, importantly, is to note that don't look at this date 2004. Look at the lease tenure start date 1997. So currently it's 27 years old. There is a balance list of 72. Follow this framework. I tap it out here for you. SB465. Sell
car plate number
before. Sell before 65 years balance. So always remember SB465. If you wait until it's 60 years old and you sell, and then you hit the second muscle of the bias curve, the next buyer cannot use CPF totally, then it'll be harder to sell. Leave 5 years for your next buyer, all right? Sell SB465. Just remember this. And also take note that when you buy 1,000, 5,006 now, you want to sell next time, perhaps you want to sell 1,008. So take note that your exit price is about 1,008, maybe in, I don't know, a few years time. But anyway, you must remember that now there's a balance of 672. At max, you stay for 7 years, sell before 65. All right, that's my advice. Okay, final question before we end today's episode. Have a look at this. After 5 years of MOP, a HDB will sell for 900K if that's the norm for new BTO. I think perhaps talking about 4 room in a certain location, maybe like a more prime area on the MRT. I fear for future Singaporean, those have not purchased with priced out. Is this even sustainable? What do you guys think about BTO that were MOP? Mm. Is the pricing very high? And then sustainability of all this HDB pricing? What do you guys think?
I think the plus one is that there are choices. A few things. Of course, when asset prices go up, but fundamentally, we also need to remember that fresh grad income is also growing, right? So when you pair it to that, it is not so out of whack from that angle. And I think there are choices for like different kind of income levels in Singapore. So if let's say, for example, I want to go for the most palatable entry price, I have the BTO route. I just need to have some time to wait. So maybe I have to stay with my family for a while. We always do not have to go for a 5 years MOP kind of unit. That is for people who really want something that is really new, minimized renovation. If it's just for a certain location, you can always consider older flats like 10, 15, 20 years old, and that pricing will be more palatable for the same condition. But most important, I think the asset prices are going up, but not to forget that our income is also going up. Mm. And in essence, the government also put in place grants to help to bridge certain price gap. Let's say you are in an income group that you need more help, there are more subsidies and grants available. So I think the whole spectrum is quite well taken care of.
Yeah, I think like what Yurong said, the first thing that came to my mind when I read this was really that there are options. If you are very, for this season, you're very tight on your budget, there are always other options. Even if you want to go for closer to MRT, then of course, there are certain aspects, like maybe in terms of the lease that you have to compromise on. There's no perfect 10 upon 10. You either compromise on some of your lifestyle factors or you compromise on the pricing. But there are options that are available. And I think the government has also put in a lot of regulations to ensure that while it is 900K now, it does not all end up in a situation where majority or more than 50% are like touching your 1.5 million. Like there are regulations in place to ensure that there's still growth, but it is controlled manner. Yeah.
All right. So we've come to the end of our Ask Us Anything. We hope to see you on the next episode. Keep your questions coming in. And of course, we have launched our brand new NOTG Telegram channel. This is our community that we want to build. Feel free to join our Telegram group by clicking the link below in the description box. That will bring you to our community channel. Feel free to chat with other of our participants inside the channel. And of course, we hope to keep the community channel alive, and we hope to chat with you even more. See you on the next NOTG episode. And meantime, take care. Bye.